and mealy. She bought the food because it smelled good, its aroma mingling with the briny sea air, and because she hasn't eaten a thing all day, unless you count about a gallon of coffee plus another of Pepsi, and because it was something to do. After a week in Seattle, this is the day she's been dreading. Something's going to happen tonight when the full moon rises. The more anxious she's become as the day wears on, the less able she is to focus. The less she's able to focus, the more anxious she becomes. When she could no longer sit in her hotel room, caught in the vicious cycle, she forced herself to go out for a short walk around nearby public market to clear her head. It didn't work. Not the change of scenery, not the fresh salt air, not the vigorous climb from Alaskan Way to the market, perched high above the water on Pike Street. From there, she had a bird's-eye view of a vast ocean liner sailing out of the bay. She'd seen quite a few of them, staying here on the waterfront. She even spotted the enormous Norwegian Star moored across from the hotel, and mentioned to Vic that she was supposed to sail on it last summer. Why didn't you go? Something came up with a case. I had to postpone it. Story of my life. Kitty wants to take a cruise when I get back home. You should. Lucinda opted not to tell him that in just a few weeks she's scheduled to be back here in Seattle, departing on the Star, bound for Alaska at last. Back here? Or still here? She's all but put the cruise out of her mind for the past few months, fairly certain that she's not going to be going anywhere unless this case is solved. Even if it is solved, a solo cruise might not be her idea of the best way to celebrate. Maybe by then, a vacation for two will be more fitting. Okay, you need to put that right out of your mind, too. Focus. Watching a fat white gull bobbing in the water, she notices droplets landing on the choppy blue-gray surface and realizes it's raining again. She flips up her hood and tosses a couple of fries toward the gull. With a swift glide and a fluttering of wings, he devours them and eyes her, waiting for more. Here you go. She tosses the contents, scattering the meal across the surface of the bay. Instantly, the gull is joined by several others, screeching and flapping and dive-bombing their way to the food. Lucinda watches the feeding frenzy for a few moments, reminded of a day with Randy last summer at a beachside grill on Long Beach Island. It was the first time she'd seen him in 3 years, lured to Beach Haven because of a missing persons case. That day, as they ate mango water ice and funnel cakes sitting across from each other on a sticky picnic table, she realized he was flirting with her and fought hard not to flirt in return. She didn't know then that his marriage was troubled. She never dreamed then that she stood a chance in hell of revisiting a relationship with him. Now, after a week on the opposite coast, talking to him several times a day and longing to see him, she's more than ready to put aside her misgivings and give it a try. She hasn't told him that, though. They've mostly talked about the case and his having sold Carla's house and his upcoming move. That's fine with Lucinda. She doesn't want to discuss a relationship over the phone. It can wait till she sees him again, whenever that is. With a sigh, she throws the container into a nearby trash can. She should get back to the hotel and check in with Vic. Somewhere in the gleaming, high-tech city sprawled on a series of steep hills behind her, someone is going to die in a few hours. Lucinda can't save the woman's life unless she figures out who and where she is, but it seems less likely with every minute that ticks by. What are the chances he'll be glad to see us? Randy asks Neil as they climb out of their respective cars in front of Frank Santiago's condo building. I'd say around zero, Neil tells him, and is surprised that Randy looks surprised. He might be dying, but I'm guessing he's still Frank. Arrogant, cranky, impossible? Exactly. In my experience, it's only in the movies that dying people turn sweet and saintly. Neil opens his car trunk and takes out the bouquet of fresh lilacs Irma cut from the yard, then adds, to be fair, I don't know. I guess there's always a chance the guy has mellowed a little. Good. Then maybe he'll just be arrogant and cranky. Wearing a wry smile, Randy tucks a manila envelope under his arm and aims his keys at the car. It chirps twice as he locks it. Ready? Let's go. What's in the envelope? Cards and notes from everyone at work, and some mail that got delivered with his name on it. I wanted to bring him something else, but nothing seemed appropriate. Those lilacs are nice, though. Irma's idea. They smell great. Yeah, Neil hesitates. You know who loves lilacs? Who? Lucinda. Every year when they're in full bloom, she comes over and parks herself next to my shrubs and inhales them for a good long time. I didn't know she liked lilacs. Loves them. I bet there's a lot you don't know about her. Randy raises an eyebrow. Like? Did you know she never liked salad until recently? No. Randy shrugs. Yeah, she knew it was good for her, so she made herself try it every once in a while, just to see if she'd changed her mind. A few months ago, she tried it again. And what do you know? She liked it? Yep. And now she eats it all the time. Says it makes her feel good. Huh. Neil nods. And that, he thinks, is all I'm going to say about that. I did my part. He can take it from there. They head up the walk, into the vestibule, ring Frank's apartment. Ever been here before? Neil asks Randy, who shakes his head. A female voice answers the intercom. Who is it? Friends of Frank's. Who? They look at each other. Neil knows Randy's thinking the same thing he is, that maybe Frank doesn't have any friends. Neil leans close to the intercom. Tell him it's Randy and Neil. There's a long pause, and then the door buzzes. It's been nearly a week since he read online that Danielle Hendry's remains were found. By now, they'll have converged here in Seattle. The FBI, Vic Shattuck, and, with any luck, Lucinda herself. Unless they're utterly stupid, they know that tonight's the night. Full moon. They probably know, too, what time he's going to make his move. Sundown. Not that there's any sun today in the rainy Pacific Northwest. So yes, they know. They're not stupid. But he's not stupid either. Far from it. They've been waiting, no doubt, for some kind of communication from him, some indication that he's here, waiting to strike. He's given them nothing. Nothing at all. This time, they're feeling their way through utter darkness. This time, he'll blindside even the victim. As much as he's enjoyed playing with the others, letting them know someone was watching them, sensing their growing apprehension, he doesn't dare indulge himself again. There's only one way to play this one smart. He's in, he's out, it's over. And then it will be Lucinda's turn. Julian Dodd emerges from the library at last and starts across Red Square. It's about time, he thinks, checking his watch before falling into step behind him. Starbucks cup in hand, Lucinda knocks on the door of Vic's room, two floors below her own. The door opens immediately. That was fast. I was about to get into an elevator when you called my cell, she tells Vic, framed in the doorway of a room littered with papers, files, and an empty pizza box sitting open on the bed. Were you on your way out? On my way in, with this. She holds up the mocha latte. Want a sip? What I want right now has a lot more kick, and I don't want to sip it. Lucinda glances at the window to ensure that it's still daylight. Did something happen already? If you're asking whether he's killed anyone yet, the answer is no. But yes, something's happened. Sit down. He closes the door behind him, locks the bolt and the chain, and indicates the lone chair. Lucinda sinks into it. He clears a spot on the bed by sweeping the pizza box and a bunch of newspapers to the floor, then sits facing her and hands her an envelope. What is this? Take a look. Lucinda pulls out an old black-and-white mugshot. Who is he? He, Vic tells her, is Scarlet. There, how does that feel? Angie, the hospice nurse, slowly raises the back of the bed they've set up in Frank's living room.
Hurts like hell.
I'm sorry. Angie starts to lower it again, but he stops her with a bony hand that looks, to him, as if it belongs to someone else, and not just because he can barely see it.
Don't. Everything hurts like hell. I might as well be able to look at them.
It's so nice that you've got company, Frank, isn't it?
Funny. I was just thinking that now I know how all those perps felt when I chased them down. Cornered by the cops. No place to run.
Angie laughs, and he manages a weak smile.
Turn that off, will you?
Frank gestures at the television, where a couple of overly made-up, middle-aged women are crying about something as violin music rises in the background. He doesn't want anyone thinking he's lying here watching the soaps. Angie likes them, so he lets her turn them on in the afternoons. When he's not sleeping, he watches with the eye that isn't yet blind. It makes the time go by. I'll go make some more coffee. She's the only one who ever drinks it, now that Frank has such a hard time swallowing. Except for the one other day he had visitors. The kids came to see him, with Ellen and her husband. That was a barrel of laughs. Ellen and the kids cried a little, and the doofus Ellen married had the nerve to tell him not to worry, that he'd see that Frank's family was taken care of. When was that? A few days ago? A few weeks? His mind used to be so sharp. Now it's mush, because of all the medication, Angie and Mary and the others say. The medication? Who are they kidding? It's the tumors. Cancer cells choking out brain cells, killing them off, killing him. Most of the time, he just wants it to be over. He hears the knock on the door, the rumble of voices, Angie introducing herself to Neil and Randy, speaking to them in a hushed tone. For all he knows, she's telling them he'll be dead by tonight, or tomorrow, or next Monday, whatever the case may be. Then again, she'd probably tell him, too, if he asked. These hospice people aren't like the doctors. They're honest. If you ask them a question, they'll answer it. No bullshit. When Frank realized that, he stopped asking. Maybe he doesn't really want to know when it's going to happen, after all.
Hey, Frank.
He hears Neil Bullard's voice, knows that he's standing over him. But he can't see him. He's blind in that eye, Angie whispers, and it's painful for him to turn his head. If you go over there, he'll be able to see you.
I'm blind, but I'm not deaf,
Frank manages to say. Then Neil appears, with Randy beside him. He feels one of them touching his hand.
Hey, Frank. How are you, Frank?
He wants to tell whichever of them asked the question that it's a stupid one, but he can't, because he suddenly has a lump in his throat. Both his eyes are swimming with tears, damn it. He doesn't want them to see him lying here, crying, wasting away, dying. But here they are, and here he is, and he might as well make the best of it. He coughs away the fluid in his lungs, then asks,
"You catch that guy yet?"
They don't ask who.
"We're closing in," Neil tells him. "We'll get him." "Let me know when you do."
"I will." Randy speaks up. "I brought you some cards and notes from everyone at work, Frank." "I'll read them to him later," Angie's voice says. He can't see her, but he can feel her, doing something with the IV bag hanging above him on his blind side. "And Frank, they brought you some beautiful lilacs. I'll put them in a vase where you can see and smell them."
"Better hurry up, while I can still see and smell,"
he quips, then coughs again painfully.
"Is there anything we can do for you, Frank?"
Neil asks, so concerned that Frank is moved all over again.
"Not for me,"
he tells them.
"But you can do something for yourselves. Live."
"Live?" Randy echoes.
"Yeah. Don't just exist. Live every damned beautiful day. Don't forget. Got it?"
He sees Neil and Randy exchange a glance.
"Got it, Frank." "Good."
Worn out, he closes his eyes. "Is he?" someone asks. "He's just tired," Angie tells them. "You take a nap now, Frank."
"Bye, Frank. We'll come back."
"Goodbye," he thinks, and drifts off to the dark place where it doesn't hurt.
Hi, you've reached the voicemail of John Ruzzacino. I'm unavailable to take your call at the moment, but if you'll leave a message, I'll get right back to you.
Mr. Ruzzacino, it's Cam Hastings, Avenire's sister. We spoke last week. I'd appreciate it if you could call me as soon as possible. I just found something interesting, and I wanted your take on it. Cam hangs up the phone and turns back to Grace, watching her in the baby swing that rocks gently with a rhythmic, clicking sound. I wish I could call Lucinda, Cam tells her. But we can't bother her, can we? Not today, of all days. Grace gives her a drooly smile. I didn't think so. Cam dabs at her daughter's chin with a burp cloth. Poor baby is teething like crazy. It's almost time for us to go get Tess at the train station, Gracie. She unstraps the baby from the swing and lifts her out. What do you think? Will your sister be happy or sad today? Grace gurgles. Happy? I hope you're right, baby girl. Cam's caught fleeting glimpses of the old Tess this past week. They've got a long, long way to go, but she seems to be coming out of her depression. Yesterday, Cam even caught her playing peekaboo with Grace, laughing at her baby sister's gales of giggles. Holding the baby against her shoulder, breathing her sweet, clean smell, Cam crosses the room to the arched windows. Spring is in full bloom out there. The rhododendron and azalea border at the back of the deep lot is laden with splashy pink and purple blossoms. For Mother's Day last weekend, Cam went to the nursery and came back with flats of annuals. She planted them right away in the flower beds at the front of the house, remembering all too well that she'd skipped the ritual last year. Mike had just moved out, and she was alone here with Tess, secretly pregnant, enmeshed in AA. What a difference a year makes. Her gaze falls on the weathered wooden playset in the far corner of the yard, next to the shed. Tess wouldn't let them get rid of it as they had planned when she became a teenager. Not that she ever used it. But Cam guessed she was clinging nostalgically to one of the tangible reminders of her not-so-distant childhood. None of them ever dreamed that another little girl would one day play there. But next year, at this time, Grace will be gleefully sliding down the slide, just as her big sister once did. Cam's own girls are as far apart in age as she and Ava were. Thinking of her sister with a pang of regret, as always, she again wishes she could call Lucinda to share what she discovered on the internet a little while ago. Any other day, she would. But Lucinda's still on the opposite coast, staking out a murderer who's supposed to strike tonight. And really, all Cam has is a hunch, based on what? A name that's fairly common? A physical description that could apply to thousands of guys? And circumstantial evidence? It's not much, but it's something. Finally, something. A few days ago, Janet O'Leary had told her that there was no student by the name of John Stockman enrolled at Buff State when Sandra Wubner was there. Cam wasn't surprised. She just kept searching the internet, checking out every John Stockman she could find. Nothing. She tried plugging in Stockman and NYU, Stockman and Neary, Stockman and Buffalo, Stockman and Wubner, hoping to trigger a relevant search engine hit. Still nothing. Today, struck by inspiration, she typed in Stockman and murder. And there it was. Scarlet was a man? Lucinda is incredulous, as Vic expected, gazing down at the old mugshot in her hand. The guy is young and handsome, with big dark eyes fringed by sooty lashes. His name is Ricky Parker, Vic tells her. He was arrested in New York a few times back in the 60s. For what? Soliciting, among other things. He was a drag queen, lived in the Bronx, but he danced in a club down in Greenwich Village. His stage name was Scarlet. He always wore red gowns when he performed, and red lipstick. Vic watches Lucinda's eyes widen. How did you find him? And what does he have to do with our case? Annabelle's had a team combing old cold case files, crimes occurring in the Northeast back in the 60s, looking for early unsolved murders that might have been connected to the Night Watchman. So you think this guy is the Night Watchman? No, I think this guy is one of his victims. Ricky Parker was hacked to death in his apartment back in June of 1967. They didn't catch the killer? I'm not sure how hard they tried. That wasn't long before Stonewall. Tough city cops didn't exactly think highly of transvestites back then. He doesn't elaborate, but she nods, seeming to get the picture. Some prints were lifted at the scene, he tells her. They couldn't come up with a match back then. What about now? We're sure as hell going to try. Cam wasn't sure at first that there was a connection between her sister and the search results for Stockman and murder. Now that she's had time to process what she found, she can't imagine that there isn't a connection. In 1970, shortly after Ava died, a 25-year-old drifter and draft dodger named Andrew J. Stockman was arrested in Syracuse for the murder of a young Syracuse University student named Sheila Wright. I know what happened to her. Solve it, and if you are W-R-I-G-H-T, you will find me. The first few misspellings were meant to throw them off. The last was no accident. Trying to study for her chemistry final at her desk in her dorm room, Kelly can think only of the chemistry she'd shared, or at least thought she'd shared, with Julian Dodd, both on stage and off. Ask me how do I feel from this chemistry lesson I'm learning. Last night, when she'd sung that line to him during her giddy "If I Were a Bell" solo, he'd looked at her as though he couldn't wait to be alone with her. Obviously, he was acting. Because after the final curtain call, Julian left. She had assumed they'd go over to the cast party together. She looked for him everywhere, even venturing into the men's dressing room. When she couldn't find him, she finally went alone to the party, thinking he must have figured he'd just see her there. Disappointing, but not devastating. Devastating was when he never even showed up. Somebody said that his hometown girlfriend had been in the audience, that he'd gone off somewhere with her after the show. How could that be? At least Christina didn't bother to say, "I told you so." She was too busy basking in the adulation of fawning underclassmen. Bewildered, Kelly went back to her room and cried herself to sleep. This morning, she'd told herself she was not going to call Julian. Then she had. 3 times. She texted him, too, asking, "Are you okay?" Who knows? Something horrible might have happened to him when he was walking from the theater to the party. She knows. Something horrible definitely happened to her. She'd ignored the little voice in her head that told her a smooth, older guy like Julian could not possibly fall in love with a nerdy freshman like her. Now she can't wait until the semester is over, and she can escape to her parents' farm near Spokane. She never wants to see Julian Dodd again. "That's it. I can't do this anymore." Lying on her loft bed, Kelly's roommate, Renee, snaps her textbook closed. "I'm starving. Want to go get something to eat?" Realizing she's starving too, Kelly nevertheless shakes her head. "I need to study."
"That's all you've done for the past 3 hours.
"No, all she's done is think about Julian."
"Come on, Kel, take a break."
She breaks off as her phone signals a new text message. She checks it.
"Oh my God, it's from Julian."
Sheila Wright, like Cam's sister and the others, was a beautiful girl with long hair parted in the middle. Cam learned, from reading several articles about him online, that Stockman had been stalking Sheila for a week or two before she died. Stockman had a gun. The girl fought hard for her life. Her screams roused campus security, and an officer arrived in the midst of the struggle, just in time to see Stockman's gloved hand close around Sheila's fingers as she grasped the gun. He twisted the barrel so that it aimed at her temple and pulled the trigger. Sheila Wright died instantly. Andrew J. Stockman went to prison. Attica. Cam found a photo of him online. He was stocky, with black framed glasses and pockmarked skin. But he couldn't have written the red lipstick note to her, because a little over a year after his arrest, he'd been killed during the infamous prison riot. Sitting on the bed in her hotel room, Lucinda mutes the local news on television and calls Randy. It's almost 11 o'clock. He's probably getting ready for bed. He answers the phone immediately, as though he'd been holding it in his hand when it rang.
"Are you okay?"
"How was Frank when you went to see him, Randy?"
"He looked awful. Emaciated, barely alive. It really makes you think, seeing someone like that."
Then he told her again to be careful, and she promised him again that she will be. She's keeping her promise, all but barricaded in her hotel room for the past few hours, just in case. The FBI has stationed a guard on the corridor outside her room tonight, too, just in case. Just in case Lucinda Sloan is the night watchman's intended victim in Seattle. The sun sets in less than a half hour. "I'm fine," she assures Randy now. "Just thought I'd call and say goodnight."
"What are you doing?"
"Same thing I was doing last time we spoke. Keeping an eye on the local news in case something happens, waiting for the killer's face or the victim's name to pop up in my head so that we can reach her before he does."
"You're not getting anything?"
"Nothing at all, although..."
"What?"
"Did you ever hear this song?"
Feeling a little ridiculous, she sings the only line she knows. If I were a bell, I'd be ringing. Then hums the melody for a few more bars.
I've heard it. I think it's old, but I don't really know it. Why?
I don't know. It's been stuck in my head, on and off, for a while now. Today it's on again.
That happens to me sometimes. You must have heard it someplace.
I guess. Any other day, she wouldn't think much of it. But today... Randy, I have to go. I'll talk to you in the morning.
Wait. Do me a favor. You don't have to stay on the phone with me. But call me back at 8:30.
Why? It'll be so late there.
I'll be awake. Just call me. Okay?
Okay.
She knows why. He wants to make sure she's survived sunset.
Renee climbs down from her bed and comes over to read the text message over Kelly's shoulder. Can you meet me on the trail by the stream out near Graves Field?
No way,
Kelly says. Wait, maybe he wants to explain what happened last night.
Now? After he ignored me all day?
You never know. There might be a good reason. Frowning, Kelly texts back. Why?
Good, Renee says.
See? At least give him a chance to explain. It doesn't take long for the reply.
I want to ask you something.
Trying to tamp a flutter of anticipation in her belly, Kelly turns to her roommate.
What do you think he wants to ask me?
I don't know, but you're crazy if you don't find out.
Kelly responds, ask me now. She holds her breath, waiting. It doesn't take long. In person, please, I want to see you. Neil knows from experience that a telephone ringing in the dead of night never means anything good, unless one of your daughters happens to be in labor. His aren't. He's sitting in front of the 11 o'clock news when the phone rings, not because he cares about what's going on locally, but because he's still haunted by seeing Frank today and consumed with worry about his extra daughter, Lucinda. He crosses himself quickly, praying it's not bad news, and picks up the phone.
Neil, I'm so sorry to call you this late.
Lucinda. She sounds breathless, in a rush, but she's okay. Thank you, God. Neil crosses himself again.
It's okay, he tells her. I was up. Anything yet? Did they get a print match on that drag queen case in the Bronx?
Nothing yet. You like old music. What song is this? I only know one line. Here, I'll sing it.
She does. Relieved that she's obviously doing just fine, and puzzled that she called him for this, Neil asks,
are we playing Name That Tune?
Do you know the name of the song?
Sure, so do you. You just sang it.
If I were a bell, I'd be ringing. That's the title?
Yep, it's from one of my favorite musicals, Guys and Dolls. When the girls were little, Irma's mother came to stay one night, and I drove her up to New York to see it on Broadway. It was...
Guys and Dolls. Broadway. She cuts in. Oh, no, Neil.
What's wrong?
I don't even want to say it, but...
Sin, what's going on?
Bradley, she says. Bradley was in Guys and Dolls on Broadway. That song's been going through my head for days now, and I didn't know why. Maybe it doesn't mean anything, but...
Maybe it does.
Sitting by the computer, Cam waits for a response from John Rutsuccino. She spoke to him a little while ago and asked if she could email him a photo to look at. She had saved it as a separate JPEG attachment, not wanting to send any information about the murder of Sheila Wright or Attica, nor did she mention who it was, or whom she suspected it was, anyway. She just asked that John open it as soon as possible and let her know his reaction.
Will do, was his jaunty reply.
Mike is a few feet away on the couch, ostensibly watching a post-game report on the Yankees. On an ordinary night, He'd be dozing in front of the television at this hour. Not tonight. She sighs. Anything yet? He asks, glancing her way.
Trust me, you'd know.
A watched email box never boils, or something like that. He yawns.
Why don't you go to bed? You have to be up at 5:30.
He shakes his head. I want to see what this guy has to say.
What if he doesn't get back to me tonight?
You asked him to.
I know, but what if...
She shakes her head. She can't bring herself to say it. Her instincts tell her that John Ruzzicino is a good guy. That's not all her instincts are telling her today. Earlier, she'd had another vision of that girl in the 1950s getup. All along, she'd been thinking she was having a vision of a long-ago crime scene, which isn't typical, because she usually sees things before they happen. Only this time, she realized the scene might be contemporary, that the girl might be wearing some kind of costume. In the vision this time, she was text messaging into a cell phone, and they certainly didn't have cell phones 50 years ago. Cam doesn't know what to make of the vision, but it's troubling. You've got mail, the computer announces. She hurriedly drags the cursor over to the mailbox icon.
Mike, it's from John Ruzzicino.
Hanging up the phone with Neil, Lucinda immediately dials Vic's number to tell him what's going on.
Guys and dolls, he echoes. You think your friend might be the night watchman because he once was in Guys and Dolls?
Bradley? The night watchman? It's preposterous. And yet, for some reason I'm making some kind of connection, Vic. Can you have someone look into it?
Of course. Sit tight. I'll call you back.
She hangs up, releases the mute setting on the television. On the local news channel, they're discussing the weather. Rain.
What else is new?
The sun sets tonight at 8:26 p.m. The cheery meteorologist spews the statistic along with several others, but all Lucinda cares about is the sunset. It's 18 minutes away. Damn it. Bradley. What if it's him? She can try to reach him, right now. See where he is and what he's doing.
What are you going to say? She asks herself, even as she dials his cell phone.
Bradley, if you're about to kill someone, please don't. His phone rings a few times before he picks up, sounding sleepy.
Bradley, where are you?
Home. In bed. Where are you?
Working.
I wish I could say the same. He yawns. I thought you were going to make opening night.
I meant to. I'm so sorry I missed it. I'll catch it as soon as I get back.
Back? Where are you?
Away, on business.
Well, don't rush home to see the show because you already missed closing night, which actually you could have attended because it was opening night.
Oh, Bradley, I'm sorry.
Not as sorry as I am.
Now is not the time to comfort a once again out-of-work actor. The clock is ticking. Suddenly, there's a loud pounding on Lucinda's door. For a moment, she's seized by panic. Then she hears Vic's voice calling to her.
Open up, Lucinda. It's important.
Bradley, I have to go.
Now? But I was going to tell you about...
I'm sorry, Bradley. We'll have to talk later. Something is going on here, and it's important.
Isn't it always? Thanks for calling, Lucinda.
His tone is sarcastic. She can't worry about that now. She hangs up, throws the phone onto the bed, and hurries over to the door.
Lucinda!
It sounds like him, but she checks through the peephole to make sure it really is Vic at the door.
Yes, of course it's Vic. You heard Vic's voice. Who else would it be?
But it's 8:11, and she's not taking any chances.
I'm here, hang on.
She opens the locks, opens the door.
Did something happen?
Guys and Dolls, that show just played all weekend at UW.
UW?
University of Washington. A body was discovered on campus about an hour ago.
An hour ago? But that's too early.
It was a guy. They think he was mugged.
Then why?
He was in the show, Lucinda. Guys and Dolls. Let's go.
The rain stopped earlier, leaving the dense foliage along the path dripping and the bugs rattling and chirping. Cars rumble on the distant road, and Kelly's own breathing sounds oddly loud in her own ears. This is a bad idea. A very bad idea. And yet here she is, walking along a deserted path at dusk, against her better judgment.
Julian,
she calls, wishing he had told her where exactly they were supposed to meet. No reply. All right, this is really stupid. She doesn't know this part of campus very well. In fact, she's never been down here alone, and certainly not at night. Maybe she should have asked Renee to come with her, but that wouldn't have been very romantic, and hearing a footfall behind her, she spins around.
Julian?
No, a male voice croons. Not Julian. Terror grips her.
Who is it?
The only reply is laughter, harsh and high-pitched. She tries to run, but he grabs her by the hair, jerks her head back so that her neck is arched, and she can see nothing but the dark silhouette of tree branches far overhead. Seeing the glint of something silver coming at her, she's certain it's a knife, and he's going to hold it to her throat and, dear God, please don't let him rape me. But it isn't a knife. She feels something pressing against her mouth, a waxy substance smearing across her lips, and it's bizarre. And thank God it isn't a knife. Then she sees the knife coming toward her. There's no time to waste, Kelly. You have to die right. The world goes black. Cam highlights John Ruzzuccino's email and clicks the mouse to open it. The document contains three words. That's John Stockman. Phone in hand, Randy paces through the cottage, from the captain's quarters to the galley and back again, doing his best not to let his imagination take him to a dark place. Lucinda is fine. She promised she'd stay in her room. But it's almost 8:30, and she hasn't called. He can call her. No. She said she'd call at 8:30. In 1 minute, the phone is going to ring, and everything will be fine. Just don't think about it. Think about something else. The move. He's moving in a few days. He'll be glad when he doesn't have to look at this nautical crap anymore. Glad to be in a generic mainland condo. Who cares if it'll take him forever to get to work and back for the next few months with summer traffic? He'll be closer to Lucinda. Okay, it's 8:30. Wait one more minute, and if she doesn't call, you can call her. He waits. She doesn't call. He calls her. The phone rings, rings, rings. Randy's chest is starting to constrict. Hi, you've reached Lucinda Sloan. I'm not able to take your call right now. Please leave a message. Lucinda, it's me. Where are you? You said you'd call. He hangs up abruptly, dials 411. Seattle, he says in response to the automated voice. The Marriott Hotel.
Which Marriott in Seattle, sir?
I don't know.
She said something about being able to see the bay from her room.
Is there one on the water?
The Marriott waterfront. I'll connect you.
Moments later, the hotel operator is on the line. I need to be connected to a guest room, he tells her. Lucinda Sloan.
One moment, please.
For a split second, he's grateful to have gotten the right Marriott on the first try. Then it occurs to him that anyone wanting to see if she's registered in that hotel would have been able to confirm it, just like that. The night watchman knows she's in Seattle. All he'd have had to do to find her would be to call one local hotel after another, asking for her until he was connected to a room. The phone rings. 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 No answer, and a cyclone of panic engulfs Randy. She said she'd be there, said she wasn't going anywhere, promised she'd call him. There's only one explanation. Something's happened to her. Racing toward the campus, seated with Vic in the back seat of a black SUV, Lucinda stares at the dashboard clock. A few minutes ago, as she watched it turn from 8:25 to 8:26, she could see it all. The knife, the blood, the red lipstick. She heard it, too. A man laughing hysterically as a woman gasped her dying breath. Lucinda doesn't know who or where the woman is. She couldn't get a good look at her face or any identifying characteristics other than her mouth, contorted, bleeding, grotesquely smeared with red lipstick. All she knows is that it's too late. Again. Riding across campus, head bent low over the handlebars of the bicycle, he sees telltale flashing lights in the distance, right where he left Julian Dodd, with his throat neatly slit and a book of Ibsen plays clutched in his hands. He left the kid's backpack there, but took his wallet along with his cell phone, making it look, at least for now, like a random mugging. By the time they find Kelly Patterson and make the night watchman connection, he'll be hundreds of miles away from Seattle. There are 65,000 people on this campus, Al Baterski tells Vic and Lucinda, sitting across the desk from him. Since I came here in the late 80s, there have been 3 murders. None of them were random. This looks like it might have been. Vic wants to remind him that looks can be deceiving, but that would put the burly head of the University Police Department on the defensive. Did this boy have any enemies? Was he dating anyone that you know of? I hear he was dating everyone. Al flashes them a wry smile. And I don't know about enemies, but his wallet and phone were taken, so again, this looks like a random mugging. Vic isn't so sure about that at all. Was there anything unusual about the way the body was found? Not really. He had just come from the library this afternoon and he was holding a book in his hands. What book was it? Lucinda asks. A collection of plays by, let's see. He consults a notepad. Henrik Ibsen. Ibsen. He wrote A Doll's House. Very good, Agent Shattuck. Baterski smiles briefly. Were you a lit major? Theater? No, but I know a little about it. A doll's house. Guys and dolls. Coincidence? Glancing at Lucinda, Vic sees that it hasn't escaped her, either. A uniformed officer sticks his head into the small office. Hey, Al? What's up? Sorry to interrupt, but we've got a girl out here who says her roommate went to meet that Dodd kid a little while ago. Vic feels Lucinda stiffen beside him. Bring her in, Baterski commands the officer, then looks belatedly at Vic. Is that okay? Sooner the better, Vic tells him. Moments later, a shaken-looking girl is escorted into the office. She has a blonde ponytail, a round face, and frightened-looking brown eyes. This is Renee Danziger, the officer informs them. Have a seat, Renee. Who's your roommate?
Her name is Kelly Patterson.
She sinks into a chair. And you don't know where she is right now? The girl shakes her head.
She went to meet Julian a little while ago.
Was she dating him?
She thought so. They were in the show together.
Lucinda's head snaps up.
Guys and dolls?
Renee nods.
Kelly had the lead. She was really into Julian, but everyone knows he's a player. That's why I was surprised he wanted to see her tonight. So was she. Then after she left, one of my friends called and told me he'd been killed. I'm so freaked out.
She starts crying. Renee, Al Baterski plucks a tissue from the box and hands it to her. That doesn't mean something happened to her. Maybe when he didn't show up, she went somewhere else, or...
No, you don't understand. She got a text message from him saying he wanted to meet her.
When?
I don't know, maybe an hour ago?
Baterski looks at Vic and Lucinda. The kid's been dead longer than that. We found his body before 7 o'clock.
Renee, Vic says urgently, do you know where your friend was supposed to meet him? On the trail by the stream behind Graves Field. Speeding along on a bicycle through the dark streets of Seattle, he can almost hear his mother telling him to be careful. Story of his life. Until that late November day in 1969. The coldest crime of all, the prosecuting attorney called matricide during his closing arguments. The jury stared at him, and he knew they were going to convict. He was right. He's always right. They deliberated for less than an hour, found him guilty of manslaughter, the taking of a human life without premeditation. Ha! If they only knew. But they didn't. They had no idea who he really was, nothing at all to link him to the murders of all those women. That, and being safe from the draft, were what kept him going for all those years, gloating as he kept tabs from behind bars on both Vietnam and the news that law enforcement officials from Maine to the Great Lakes, including the FBI, were continuing their search for the night watchman. What power there was for him, from his safe haven behind 30-foot-high, gun-tower-topped concrete walls, to observe the bumbling, ongoing search for a serial killer. What power in the fact that he alone knew their search would remain fruitless? What power in knowing the guards had no clue to his true identity? In prison, it was all about control. The guards had it. The prisoners relinquished it. Or so it usually went. Not for him. He was in control, always. Even if nobody realized it but him. In prison, when they weren't ignoring him altogether, they were treating him like a nobody. How he gloated over that. Idiots had no clue that he was somebody. Somebody to be feared. Somebody to be reckoned with. But they would know one day. The whole world would know. For the time being, he would serve his sentence with time off for good behavior. He would take advantage of every class, academic and vocational, and, in particular, computer technology, offered at Attica. Someday, he would get back to his business, and no one would ever be the wiser. No one, that is, except Stockman. Standing a few yards from Kelly Patterson's corpse in the flood-lit thicket just off the trail, Lucinda desolately watches the investigators take measurements, snap photos, bag potential evidence found nearby on the path, a soda can pop top, a coin, a plastic hair clip. Kelly's throat is slashed. Her mouth is smeared with red lipstick. And on her wrist is a freestyle watch, the hands fixed at 8:26 p.m. Less than an hour ago. It could have ended so differently. If only Lucinda had figured out sooner what that song meant. If only they'd gotten to Kelly before he did. They could have intercepted the message sent from Julian Dodd's stolen cell phone. They could have been here waiting for him when he showed up to kill her at sunset. Could have. If only. Randy. She forgot to call him. Immediately, she reaches into her pocket for her cell phone and realizes it isn't there. Did she leave it behind in her room? She ran out of there when Vic showed up. She hurries over to where he stands, talking intently to a couple of guys from the local field office. Vic, can I borrow your phone, please? It'll only take 2 seconds. He tosses it to her without missing a conversational beat, and she steps away to make the call. It's after midnight there now, but something tells her Randy didn't calmly drift off to sleep when he didn't hear from her. Hello? She can hear the dread in his voice when he answers, on the first ring. It's me. Oh, God. Thank God. When I saw that this call wasn't coming from my phone, I thought, no, I'm okay. I'm so sorry I couldn't call to let you know, but you're okay, he echoes raggedly. She quickly brings him up to date, telling him the tragic story of Kelly and Julian. Where are you now? I'm at the crime scene, and I'm on Vic Shattuck's phone. She breaks off, seeing Vic and the agents hurrying toward a couple of investigators who are positioning more spotlights to illuminate the path. They must have found something there. I have to go, Randy, she says hurriedly. I just wanted you to know I was okay. I'll talk to you tomorrow. Good.
Wait. There's something I want you to know, too. Don't say anything, okay? Just listen to me. I love you, Lucinda. I've been waiting to say that for so damned long. I love you. Now go.
Stunned, she stands holding the phone against her ear.
Lucinda, Vic calls. Come over here and look at this.
In a perfect world, they would burst into the room at the Motel 6, registered to a John Knight and paid for in cash, to discover the unsub there, asleep in his bed. But the world is far from perfect. There's no doubt that the key card they discovered on the path near Kelly's body belongs to her killer. There were drops of blood on it. But when the agents storm the room, it's empty. Summoned to take a look, Vic and Lucinda cross the threshold to see that the bed hasn't been slept in. There's no luggage.
Maybe he'll be back,
one of the agents speculates, as another calls in the forensics team to start dusting for fingerprints. He won't be back.
How do you know?
Vic asks Lucinda, who merely shrugs.
Yeah,
stupid question. How does she know anything? He's still amazed by the way she made the guys and dolls connection. Amazed that they'd come so close to saving the lives of those two kids. So close to catching the unsub that if Vic allows himself to dwell on any of it, he'll be physically sick.
Look at this.
On his hands and knees, one of the agents holds up a yellow slip of paper clamped in a pair of tweezers.
This guy's getting sloppy.
Sloppy. Vic tilts his head thoughtfully. The agent examines the slip of paper. This is a mail order receipt dated back in January from Star Jewelers in New York for 5 watches, plus engraving. Sloppy indeed.
No, Vic shakes his head. No way.
What's wrong, Vic? Lucinda asks.
The unsub is highly organized, meticulous. Why would he suddenly have gotten sloppy enough to not only leave the hotel room key at the scene, but a receipt in the room?
Lucinda stares at him. He wouldn't. He wanted us to find both. Is that what you're thinking?
That's exactly what I'm thinking.
At every scene, he left us a clue to where he's going next.
That receipt, he tells her resolutely, is going to give us the answer.
Chapter 23. The nurses in the hospital corridor greet Cam by name and fuss over Grace as she pushes the stroller toward her father's room. How is he today? She asks.
Pretty good.
Pearl, a no-nonsense old-school nurse, gives a satisfied nod. Glad to hear it, Cam rolls Grace into her father's room. He spots them immediately, which is a good sign. Sometimes it takes him a while to tune out the television or whatever else he's absorbed in.
Well, well, well. Look who's here.
Sitting up in his hospital bed, Ike Neary looks better, if anything, than his old self. His gray hair is clean and combed into a neat ponytail. His frame has filled out thanks to a steady, healthy diet, and his eyes aren't bloodshot, courtesy of booze and pot. Yet looks can be deceiving, Cam knows. In one of life's bitter ironies, her father is fading away, even as his body bounces back from years of hard living.
Who's here, mon?
Nigel, the Jamaican male nurse, asks, nodding a hello to Cam as he finishes writing something on a clipboard chart.
What's the matter? You don't have eyes, my daughter.
Which daughter, though, Pop? Cam wants to ask, because you never can tell where his mind is at. He pats the bed.
Sit down over here with your old man, Cam, and let me get a look at that beautiful grandbaby.
Relieved, she looks at Nigel.
It's okay, he says. I'm finished. Enjoy your visit. Good to see you, Cam. See you tomorrow, Ike.
Where are you going?
It's 3. My shift is over.
All right. Give me some skin, brother.
Cam's father holds up his hand. With a grin, Nigel slaps it,
then gives Grace a little pat as Cam rolls the carriage over to the bed.
She's getting big.
Yes, she is. See you later. As he leaves, her father says,
He's one cool cat, that Nigel. What a surprise to find him working here.
What do you mean, Pop?
He used to play sax with Bruce down in Asbury. Called himself Clarence back then.
Cam's heart sinks. She doesn't let her father see her face as she lifts Grace, dressed all in pink, out of the stroller.
Look at you. How's my beautiful girl?
Ike holds out his arms.
Come to Granddad.
Cam gently places the baby on her father's lap, then sits beside him. You look good today, Pop.
I feel good.
He tickles the baby and is delighted when Grace rewards him with a big smile.
You know who she looks like when she smiles?
Cam nods. Tess.
Yes, Tess. Who else would I be talking about?
He gestures at the baby.
She looks like Mike.
Momentarily confused by his phrasing, Cam grasps it when her father goes on to tell Grace,
Yes, you do, Tessie. You look just like your daddy.
Cam sighs inwardly. When she came here today, she was considering telling her father what she had learned last night. She wondered whether it might bring him some peace to know that Ava didn't abandon the two of them the way Brenda had. Momentary peace, anyway. He doesn't retain much these days. And he spends enough time, as it is, living in the past. It's probably best not to dredge up old pain. Not when the truth is as ugly as the lie they've lived with for all these years. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Philadelphia International Airport. The local time is 10:42 p.m. Please remain seated until we reach the gate, but if you have a phone close at hand, you're welcome to use it now. Lucinda is already dialing. Vic picks up immediately.
I just landed.
She clears her throat in a futile attempt to make her tired voice a little less hoarse. Several cups of hot tea on the flight didn't help, though she was able to catch a few hours' sleep, her first in almost 48 hours.
Did you find out anything?
She asks Vic.
Yes, the jewelry store is in Midtown Manhattan. Hordes of people coming and going. No one remembers him. But the watches were all freestyle, and they do have a record of what was engraved on them.
And?
And they match the four we've got so far.
What about the fifth? If we know where he's planning to go next, we'll have a head start figuring out who the victim might be.
We believe we already know.
Vic's voice is oddly subdued. With a jolt, the plane arrives at the gate, and the captain sounds the bell.
What do you mean? You believe you already know the place, or who the victim might be?
Both.
Dread creeps over her. Lucinda, the fifth watch reads June 18th. 39.5, 75.1.
Where is that?
Philadelphia.
Lucinda's flight landed 15 minutes ago, according to the arrivals board. Randy waits beside the passenger exit with a bouquet of roses. White, not red. He figures she saw enough red last night in Seattle to last her a lifetime. She sounded so beaten down when they spoke this morning. Rather, he spoke. She tried, but her voice was shot. He didn't bother to ask whether she'd slept last night. He knew she hadn't. In a whisper, she told him how they'd gone from the crime scene to the hotel where the unsub had been staying, only to discover he'd vanished. But the desk clerk remembered him as an older man, tall and lean, with gray hair, glasses, a beard. Now, at least, they have a description to go by. Her voice barely audible, Lucinda told him she'd be flying home to Philly tonight.
I'll call you when I land. It'll be around 10:30,
she rasped. He decided to surprise her at the airport. Now, as Randy keeps an eye on the stream of passengers exiting the gate area, he thinks about what he said to her last night, fresh from Frank's deathbed. And the advice to not just exist, but to live. I love you. The words just fell out of his mouth impulsively, but he meant them. He didn't give her a chance to respond then, even if she'd wanted to. He told himself it was because she was in the middle of a crime scene investigation, but that's not the only reason. He was afraid of what she'd say in return. Please don't love me. Or, well, I don't love you. Or God only knows what. He didn't want to hear it over the phone. Let her say it to him in person. And if that's not what she was going to say, well, he'd prefer to hear the alternative in person, too. Suddenly spotting her face in the sea of faces coming toward him, he realizes he almost missed her. And no wonder. This is Lucinda as he's never seen her. Unaware that anyone's watching, she's let down her defenses for the first time since he's known her. Ordinarily, her commanding presence makes her stick out in a crowd. Tonight, she's lost herself in one, intentionally or not. She walks slowly, shoulders hunched as though she's cold or afraid, making her look smaller than she is. Not just smaller, vulnerable. She glances around as she walks, as though she's searching for someone, not for Randy, of course. She doesn't expect him to be here. For a moment, he wonders if she arranged for someone else to meet her. Then she draws closer, and he sees that her expression isn't one of anticipation, but apprehension. He hurries toward her, wanting to let her know that she isn't alone, that he's with her, and he'll take care of her. Lucinda. She freezes, darts a glance in his direction. He waves, watches her face register shock and relief. As she hurries toward him, he realizes he can't say any of the things he was about to. The vulnerable Lucinda he glimpsed just a moment ago has vanished, replaced by a woman who stands tall, radiating strength. A woman who clearly doesn't need, or want, anyone to take care of her. So, her boyfriend decided to surprise her at the airport, did he? Leaning against a pole behind an open newspaper, he watches the couple embrace. She looks thrilled. Personally, he's never cared for surprises, not unless he's the one planning them. He must always, always be the one in control. And you always have been. Even back in September 1971, when a tense situation spiraled into utter chaos for the other 2,000-odd inmates at Attica Prison. Control amid chaos. That was the key. He seized the opportunity to do what had to be done. When the uprising was over, over 40 men lay dead, inmates and correctional personnel. As far as the rest of the world was concerned, all were casualties of the bloodiest clash in prison history. He alone knows that one among them was not. After hanging up with Lucinda, Vic presses a speed dial key to connect to a number he'd erased from the phone's memory a while back, never imagining he'd need it again. Funny how things work out. Annabelle Wyatt. I told her. How did she take it? In stride. She's a tough cookie. I told her we'll do everything possible to keep her safe, but not to let on that she knows what's going on. Good. You didn't give her any classified information, did you? He sighs inwardly. No, I didn't. Remember, she's not a part of this investigation. And you're lucky you are. Annabelle doesn't say it, but the message comes through to Vic, loud and clear. I'll be clearing the decks here and flying to Philadelphia as soon as possible, she says crisply. You do the same. Absolutely. But only after a quick detour to see his wife. In the old days, he was used to all the travel, used to being apart from Kitty for weeks at a time. Not anymore. When this case is resolved, he'll be ready for retirement at last. And this time, there will be no wistful backward glances. All right, Vic. Good work. Did you determine whether anything else found at the scene was significant? It's hard to tell. We're working on it. This is all classified. Got it? Meaning,
don't tell Lucinda. Got it. The soda can tab has probably been there for a while. The plastic clip might have flown off the victim's head. The strands that were caught in it look like a match to her hair. We'll do DNA testing on it, of course. The coin was foreign. A krona.
A krona? From Norway?
Yes, a krona. Why? Does that mean something to you? Henrik Ibsen was from Norway.
There's a moment of silence as she digests that.
So you're thinking, Norway, Annabelle. That's where he's going, not Philadelphia. He was trying to throw us off his trail. He's going to Norway.
We don't know that for sure.
No, but I'd say there's a pretty good chance.
We'll start looking into it. And remember, this is classified.
Classified. He can't tell Lucinda.
But if the watchman is headed overseas, it looks like she might be safe, for now, after all.
Lucinda prolongs the hug, keeping her face safely buried against Randy's shoulder until she's certain she's regained her composure. She probably shouldn't be so damned glad to see him, but the truth is, after what Vic just told her on the phone, she was feeling shell-shocked and alone in the world. Then, miraculously, there was Randy. Just what she needed, though she hadn't realized it until she saw him.
"What are you doing here?"
she asks, finally daring to pull back and look up at him.
"Surprising you,"